Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today is Tuesday. It's May 28th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. My name is Hezzy Eris. We've just completed a very solemn weekend, Memorial Day weekend, and there's tremendous loss that maybe some of the younger people no longer remember. And because the last major war that we were involved in that made like a major impact on people's sensibilities was probably the Vietnam War. But that was many, many years ago. And somehow we've forgotten all the people that were engaged in Iraq and in so many other places in the Middle East. So it's concerning and you know that this is what's happening. Well, today we have an interesting panel of guests. We're going to be speaking to political analyst Robert Keston from basically from 10 o'clock to 10:30. We were hoping to have a Mount Vernon mayoral candidate, the former commissioner Clyde Isley, 10:30, but he's going to be engaged in another event that is pertinent for him and I think some of the other candidates who are running for mayor in the city of Mount Vernon. So we won't be talking to him at 10:30, but rather we'll be engaged in international news to fill that half-hour time slot. Mm-hmm. But at 11 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Mayor Mike Spano, who's running for a third term. We'll be speaking to him at 11 o'clock. And if there's more international news, I'll be covering it from about 11:15 or whenever the mayor completes his thinking and discussion or whatever he's got to say, then I'll pick up at the end afterwards and we'll see what happens at the end of the day. So it looks like there is a bit of a delay with regard to Mr. Keston. So we'll just hang in there just a little bit longer in the hope that that he'll be able to come on. Well, one thing that's really interesting and it's very compelling to me is that while there's a tremendous amount of pushback with respect to the President of the United States, who is already ratcheting up his effort for re-election, the thing is that there's a lot of stuff that is being said, particularly by the Dems who are out of power. Certainly in the Senate, even though they have the majority in the Congress. But the bottom line is you've got split powers. And so the Supreme Court is basically been moved by the appointment of Supreme Court justices under the Trump administration. So it's not as liberal as it used to be. And it's turned more conservative by the two recent appointments. And you never know when there'll be a third. So many of the Supreme Court justices are quite up there in age. And then you have another issue, and that is that there's just a lot of talk, but it's all talk, and there's no real capacity evidently by the Senate or the Congress or anybody else to level actual facts and information and reveal it to the public to prove that there are issues with this presidency. And if it's just going to be constant berating of the president, which is, indicative of really the conduct of the Dems so far, then it's very unlikely that despite the fact that people are saying that there's less than 40% support of the president across the country, there is no actual basis for which to really gravitate towards the Dems. So if the Democrats can't come up with a lucid concept and plan or vision for the nation, how to respond to its left-leaning new people who are elected to office, in the words of Bernie Sanders, he says the Dems are going to lose because it's not enough just to be contrarian. You need to come up with some concepts. And In past discussions with Mr. Keston, he suggests that it's a process, and the process requires more introspection into the issues, so that the issues are not even well defined for a lot of people in politics. There has been a tremendous amount of bigotry and bias for years in this country. There's inequity even to this day. There's inequity in schooling. There's inequity in opportunity, employment, for women, for people of color, for just different aspects of an economic system that has chosen who will be the beneficiary of so much that is powerful and strong and gives one a leg up in American society, as well as from a financial perspective. And so this is something that is coming to the forefront more so than ever before. And there's very little discussion of how it can be resolved. And yet I did hear a couple of candidates that are running who are coming up with some concepts, which was I was hoping to discuss with Mr. Keston, but he probably is not able to come on today for whatever reasons. So I think that what's fascinating about all this is that, considering all the people who have been engaged and involved in politics all these years, there are over 23 or 24 people who are vying for support and prominence to eventually become the candidate of choice by the Democrats, by the Democratic Party. And so he or she will stand up and be the final candidate that people will coalesce around and about. So it's really just interesting that we don't hear good concepts. We don't understand how to move from where we are to where we, in some minds, need to be. So whether it be balancing the inequity of life, the inequity in education, the inequity in opportunity, the inequity in funding capacity, the inequity in earning a living, the inequity in so many different aspects of our lives. And interestingly enough, all these things have yet to be fully discussed. And there may also be something that I find a little bit abhorrent. So people are suggesting that, well, we can change things around. But they're suggesting that we change things around to exclude those that have been able to survive in a very cushy place in comparison to others who have not been able to be given an opportunity. And mind you, being given an opportunity is not the sort of conduct that one expects in America. America has always expected people to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and actually thrive by doing so. So, and that was expected, but there was so much bias and bigotry for so many people for so long that I guess over time, as societies evolved, it became more and more difficult to pull yourself up with one's bootstraps because the capacity to do so was usually undermined by a lack of financial capacity. So it became really, really problematic. And now I see there's a switch where people are suggesting, well, because maybe African Americans, as one example, have been not given the same opportunity as others, then therefore we should change the dynamic, or not the dynamic, but the the concept of it all. So instead of, let's say, supposedly white people getting into the better institutions of learning, we should just move them out and give it to people of color who have not been able to become part of the process. And that's one of the problems too, because that also gives us rise to a continued animosity among the people that populate our nation. And so if one wants to move into a direction which undermines so many people in the nation, then I think it becomes a real problem and it exacerbates the issues. And I really wonder then if the nation can survive by changing the dynamic. Can we survive by awaiting for a full generation of people of all colors to actually get an education, and then what? Are they going to be employable here? Are they going to be able to do the jobs that we need to do for the next 25 years, 50 years? What are we supposed to do? And all these issues are not answered. And I just think that there's such anger and such animosity of people who have not been given an opportunity, thinking that others before them did get an opportunity. They had it easier to have that opportunity, of course, than, let's say, people of color, who were ostracized in every conceivable way. And there needs to be some sort of justice for that. Again, then we have to simply look at how do we get there? How do we move forward? But for example, you have a situation here in the city of, in the state of New York. State of New York has $4.5 billion in IOUs that it owes school districts across the state. These are just IOUs. These are funds that were promised maybe 10 or 15 years ago that have accumulated over time to this particular point. And nothing's been done about it. The opportunity to do something about it was with the city of New York, particularly Queens, being able to infuse, I think it was $3.1 billion in tax credits. That's not cash, that's tax credits to Amazon, who wanted to open up a think tank in Queens. Long Island City in Queens. In other words, they weren't going to be delivering from Queens, but they were supposed to bring in people who were going to move the equation forward for Amazon. Their idea was to study and look at issues and concerns and flexibility and so many things that need to be done in order to computerize to another level of excellence. And let's face it, Amazon is an extremely successful module and modality for delivery and so on and so forth. And distribution. So the bottom line is we could have had all that because the return on $3.5 billion worth of tax credit would have returned $27 billion over time. Over 20 years, which doesn't count the after effect or the ancillary effect of all these investments of people who are going to be earning $150,000 a year, and that was for the first 15,000, and within another 10 years, another 15,000 people were going to be hired. So it was going to change the landscape for sure in Queens and the landscape in New York City. It could have moved a lot of people from wherever they were who chose to move to Queens, and also would have dislocated many people as well who were going to need to find affordable housing. And there was always talk about that as well. But, you know, just like they built Left Rack City, you could have also moved beyond the high-end housing that Amazon was thinking about, and something else could have been done as well to make affordable housing for people who were going to be dislocated by the change in the political landscape as well as in the reality landscape of housing and businesses that were there. But it didn't happen because it was the kibosh was put on it by none other than people you would have expected would have been at the forefront saying, yeah, this would be smart for us, and yet they want to forget about it. So Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the Senate leader of the Democratic Party, she's the one that appointed her deputy from the Democratic Party, Michael Giannaris, and he was able to put a kibosh on it because there was a panel, or rather like an oversight committee of three people. And if one of those three decided to put a kibosh on this project, which was Michael Giannaris, who represented the Long Island City, that was the end of that. And before you knew it, Amazon was out of there. And they could not be persuaded to come back. And nor were they interested in coming to New Jersey or to Connecticut or anywhere else in the area. They said, forget it. They didn't need it. And they went elsewhere. And I don't know what the other outlets will now be and where they're going to be building out. It wasn't so pertinent for me when I considered that it wasn't going to impact us in this general metropolitan area. But these are the sort of problems that are taking place, and yet there is no real major discussion. It was almost like, let's kill this gift and just destroy it for political purposes, and rather than for serving the public interest. And the public interest could have been served, not only those that were on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, but also those at the higher end of the economic scale who were going to be employed. And that's how it's done. So they failed. They failed miserably. And yet they want to make believe that they're there serving the public interest, which is really not the case. All right. Well, I see that it's like about, we're into the show about 17 minutes. So that's my take on this. So let's move over to the international scene, because we will have until 11 o'clock before we speak to Mayor Mike Spano. So let's move on to what's happening on the world scale. So the thing that's really interesting is that Iraq has condemned six Islamic State group members to death. So an Iraqi court sentenced today two more French members of the Islamic State group to death, bringing the total number of French former jihadis condemned to death this week to six. Men were identified as Karam El-Harchawi, Brahim Najara. They are among a group of 12 French citizens who were detained by the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, in neighboring Syria and handed over to Iraq in January. The Kurdish-led group spearheaded the fight against the Islamic State group in Syria and has handed over to Iraq hundreds of suspected Islamic State members in recent months. France's foreign minister said earlier today that his government is working to spare the group of condemned Frenchmen from execution after Iraq sentenced them to death, though France has made no effort to bring back captured French Islamic State group fighters. Now, Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian also reiterated France's position, but said the Islamic State group militants should be tried where they committed their crimes. And I think that's correct. We are multiplying efforts to avoid the death penalty for these French people, he said on France Inter Radio. He didn't elaborate, but said he spoke to Iraq's president about the case. France is outspoken against the death penalty globally. The sentencing in Iraq comes amid a controversy about the legal treatment of thousands of foreign fighters who joined the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And the sentenced men have 30 days to appeal. So the trials have been criticized by rights groups, which say they often rely on evidence obtained through torture. They also have raised the question of whether suspected Islamic State group jihadists should be tried in the region or repatriated in the face of strong public opposition at home. And France has long insisted that its adult citizens captured in Iraq or Syria must face trial locally, refusing to repatriate them despite the fact and despite the risk they face capital punishment for waging their jihadist war in the region. So the Iraqi judiciary said earlier in May that it has tried and sentenced more than 500 suspected foreign members of the Islamic State group since the start of 2018. Its courts have condemned many to life in prison and others to death, although no foreign Islamic State group members have yet been executed. So these are compelling issues, and therefore, and will eventually be resolved. Personally, I hope they all get what's coming to them in Iraq and leave it at that. And that's going to be where I think it needs to go. Now let's look at what's going on. Evidently in Algeria, we've got problems. Algeria's presidential election is likely to be delayed. Algeria's July 4 election is likely to be delayed after only two contenders submitted candidacies for the election. According to local media, both candidates are highly unlikely to meet the necessary requirements to run. Long-serving Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika stepped down in May following mass unrest throughout the country. Many pro-democracy activists believe that members of the old regime are still trying to cling to power, which has prevented a fair election process. Now, Franz Van Katz's Laura Cellier spoke to William Lawrence, professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University regarding this particular issue. So, and we'll just see where it goes. But right now it's stalemate, and we'll see what happens. Then a major atrocity happened in Japan. A man with a knife stabs children in a Japanese city, in the Japanese city of Kawasaki. So a schoolgirl and an adult man were killed and 15 other young girls injured in a stabbing at a bus stop just outside of Tokyo today. Japanese national broadcaster NHK cited authorities as saying, and another man detained at the scene also later died. So the girls, aged between 6 and 12, were students at a private Catholic school in Kawasaki City, south of Tokyo, and were boarding their school bus when the suspect attacked them, according to NHK. The driver of the Caritas Elementary School bus told police he saw a man approach the bus stop and start slashing at people, holding a knife in both hands, the broadcaster said. It said the girl who was killed was age 12. A 39-year-old man was also killed, and another woman was severely injured, along with the 15 other schoolgirls who were hurt, NHK advised. A suspect was detained at the scene after stabbing himself in the neck but died later. NHK cited police as saying it said also that the man, a Kawasaki resident, probably in his 50s, was unconscious when he was detained. The motive for the attack was not yet clear, but there was no immediate fears of a wider security threat. There have been previous examples of mass stabbings in Japan, sometimes involving the vulnerable. And the attack occurred on the final day of U.S. President Donald Trump's four-day state visit to Japan. On behalf of the First Lady and myself, I want to take a moment to send our prayers and sympathy to the victims of the stabbing attack this morning in Tokyo, President Trump said as he toured Japan's largest warship, the Kaga, K-A-G-A. All Americans stand with the people of Japan and grieve the victims and for their families, he said. TV footage showed scores of police officers and emergency vehicles at the crime scene with large areas cordoned off. A witness told NHK, the news agency, he saw people lying on the ground covered in blood, and one police officer was seen hosing down the sidewalk. I saw a boy carrying a school bag with scratches on his face, wrist, and legs in a parking lot, NHK quoted an unidentified witness as saying. He was visibly trembling, frightened, and shocked. The girls' school was located just over a kilometer from the scene of the attack, NHK said. Violent crime is relatively rare in Japan, but occasional high-profile incidents have shocked the nation. A knife-wielding man broke into a facility for the disabled in a small town near Tokyo in 2016 and killed 19 patients in their sleep. In 2001, eight children were stabbed to death by a former janitor at their school in Osaka. More than a dozen people were injured in a 2010 stabbing spree on a school bus and a commuter bus in a Tokyo suburb. Just unbelievable. There must be something that caused this, but who knows what it is. Again, more international news. Myanmar, the former Burma, now known as Myanmar, has freed soldiers jailed for the Rohingya massacre. So it seems that seven soldiers jailed for killing a group of Rohingya Muslims have been freed from a Myanmar jail despite serving less time than two reporters in prisons for exposing the massacre. Prisons Department Director General Myint So, S-O-E, told reporters and journalists the soldiers were no longer in detention, declining to give any further information. Four officers and three soldiers were sentenced in 2018 to 10 years with hard labor for killing 10 Rohingya villagers, with Army Chief Min Aung Hlaing and a civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi holding up the sentence as evidence of accountability within the military. Reuters journalists Wa Lone and Kyo So U, who helped expose the killing, were jailed last September for 7 years on charges linked to their reporting. Bear with me a moment. One second. I pressed the wrong button, so I moved off. Okay, so they were granted a presidential pardon this month after spending over 500 days behind bars. The killings unfolded during a bloody army crackdown in 2017 that forced some 740,000 Rohingya to flee across the border into Bangladesh. Now, United Nations investigators say the violence warrants the prosecution of top generals for genocide, and the International Criminal Court has started a preliminary probe. Phil Robertson, Human Rights Watch Deputy Asia Director, condemned the soldiers' release. He said it reveals the armed forces don't consider the Rohingya to be human and were, quote, never committed to setting anyone accountable for their crimes. Myanmar's social media, however, lit up with support for the soldiers. In Myanmar, the Rohingya, often referred to as Bengali, are widely seen as illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, and the Reuters duo garnered little sympathy for their investigation into the killings. The two journalists who are traitors to the country were released, so why not release the soldiers, posted Aung Min Chu. No country should jail security forces for killing terrorists, said Mao Tang. Now, the military has always justified its crackdown in 2017 as a means of rooting out Rohingya insurgents. So, and that seems to be a very, very pertinent issue that permeates the sensibilities of Myanmar. Well, we've been speaking about what's been going on in Austria for a while, and evidently, the Austrian lawmakers have ousted Chancellor Kurz in a no-confidence vote. So Austrian lawmakers voted Conservative Chancellor Sebastian Kurz's government out of office on Monday, passing a motion of no confidence days after it became a caretaker administration in the wake of a video sting scandal. Kurz's People's Party came out on top in Sunday's European Parliament election, only a week after the sting prompted Vice Chancellor Heinz Christian Strache of the far-right Freedom Party, the FPO, to step down and Kurz to scrap the coalition between their parties. Kurz hoped to use his position as chancellor during the transition as a springboard for re-election. presenting himself as more of a victim of the political crisis set off by the video than an enabler of it who brought the far right to power. But with the next parliamentary election expected in September, oh goodness, I did it again. I pressed the wrong button, so bear with me a moment. One second. Okay, so, but with the next parliamentary election expected in September, opposition parties said courts must share the blame and voted his minority government, in which FPO ministers had been replaced by civil servants. They voted them down. Courts gambled away his chances, and Mr. Chancellor, you bear full responsibility. The Social Democrats, the SPO deputy parliamentary faction head, Jörg Leichtfried, had said in a speech minutes before his party submitted the motion. FPO lawmakers earlier unanimously agreed to support the SPO motion. Combined, the two parties have a majority of 103 seats in the 183-seat lower house. Austria's president must now nominate a new chancellor to put together a caretaker government able to last until the election. While he could, in principle, choose courts again, that is highly unlikely. To topple the government a few months before an election is something few people in this country can understand, courts told lawmakers before the vote, presenting himself as a force for stability after the scandal that felled his coalition partner. Now, despite the scandal, Kurz's People's Party, the OVP, won a larger share of the vote in the European ballot than in the parliamentary election of 2017, while the SPO's share shrank. So FPO leader Strache resigned from all his political posts after the video footage, which appeared to show him discussing fixing government contracts, which was published by two German media outlets. Vienna prosecutors said they were investigating the sting video in multiple directions, quote unquote, but declined to provide further details. Strache denies doing anything illegal. Parliament will have its say on Monday, Kurz had said on Facebook, prior to the no-confidence votes. But at the end of the day, the people will decide, namely in September. The FPO's Herbert Kickl, whom Kurz forced out of his post as interior minister, forecast a different outcome. This power grab is disgusting, and voters will decide about that too in September, he told lawmakers. So it's going to be very, very compelling to see where we go with all of this. and now there's another issue, of course. That's like what's going on in Germany. Evidently, the German government is urging the wearing of Jewish kippah or skull caps to combat anti-Semitism. So the German government has called on people to wear the Jewish kippah or skull cap ahead of an anti-Israel protest as a demonstration of solidarity. And as Jews face a spike in anti-Semitism, withdrawing an earlier warning against wearing the traditional skull cap. At the weekend, Felix Klein, the country's commissioner on anti-Semitism, sparked uproar when he said in an interview with the Funke, F-U-N-K-E, regional press group, that he could not advise Jews to wear the kippah everywhere or at all the time in Germany. Now, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin voiced Shachet Klein's warning and said it was a capitulation to anti-Semitism and evidence that Jews are unsafe in Germany. Late Monday, Klein reversed course after Chancellor Angela Merkel's spokesman intervened. The state must see to it that the free exercise of religion is possible for all, and that anyone can go anywhere in our country in full security wearing a kippah, Stefan Seibert told a press conference. In his latest statement to Funke, Klein said, I call on all citizens of Berlin and across Germany to wear the kippah next Saturday if there are new, intolerable attacks targeting Israel and Jews on the occasion of Al-Quds Day in Berlin. Al-Quds is an annual event against Israeli control of Jerusalem and will take place on Saturday. Klein also addressed his earlier statement, saying that he could no longer recommend that Jews wear the kippah everywhere in Germany should be taken as an alarm signal. Earlier on Monday, German daily Das Bild, which means the picture, published a cutout and use kippah in a bid to fight rising anti-Semitism. It's cut out in their magazine. Bild, Germany's top-selling daily newspaper, called on readers to stand in solidarity with their Jewish neighbors by making their own kippah bearing the Star of David to raise the flag against anti-Semitism. And also people are wearing a kippah or a skull cap, which has the Jewish star in one panel next to the German flag in the next panel, and so on in an alternating manner in a circular fashion. So Germany, like other Western countries, has watched with alarm as anti-Semitic and other racist hate speech and violence have increased in recent years, while the political climate has coarsened and grown more polarized. Anti-Semitic crimes rose by 20% in Germany last year, according to Interior Ministry data, which blamed 9 out of 10 cases on the extreme right. The arrival in parliament of the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, AfD party, whose leaders openly questioned Germany's culture of atonement for World War II atrocities, has also contributed to the change in atmosphere. Merkel has also deplored another form of anti-Semitism, and quote-unquote, stemming from a major asylum seeker influx, with many coming from Muslim countries like Syria, Afghanistan, or Iraq. The Central Council of Jews in Germany has already issued several warnings about wearing the kippah in public. In one prominent case last year, a 19-year-old Syrian man was convicted for assault after lashing out with his belt at an Israeli man wearing a Jewish skull cap while shouting Yehudi, which means Jew in Arabic. So that was the that's where that is, and that's what's happening in Germany. Now let me just quickly go over to what's going on in Israel. Evidently, the Israeli military confirms it conducted a Syria airstrike. So Syria said that Israel carried out a missile attack that caused casualties on Monday in what Israel's army said was a retaliatory strike. An Israeli missile targeted Tel al-Shal in Quneitra, the Syrian news agency said, adding a military vehicle was targeted and there are wounded. The Israeli military confirmed it carried out an airstrike in Syria in retaliation for what it said was anti-aircraft fire targeting one of its fighter jets. The Syrian province of Quneitra includes the Golan Heights, most of which is occupied and annexed by Israel. Earlier today, Syrian anti-aircraft systems fired at an IDF, Israel Defense Force, fighter jet during a routine flight in northern Israel. The Israeli Defense Ministry IDF forces said in a statement. It said the projectile missed and the plane completed its journey before the, quote, IDF targeted the launcher that had fired at the jet. Now, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a Britain-based war monitor, said the Israeli missile was, quote, reportedly fired from the occupied part of the Golan. Its director, Rami Abdel Rahman, told Agence France-Presse that 3 Syrian soldiers were wounded. Israel has carried out hundreds of airstrikes in Syria, most of them against what it said was an Iranian and Hezbollah attack or targets. Hezbollah is a Lebanese Shiite group that supports Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, who is also backed by Tehran. The Israeli strike comes amid soaring tensions in the region between Israel's arch foe, Iran, and the United States. The standoff has been simmering since the United States last year withdrew from the 2015 nuclear treaty, which Iran reached with major world powers. In recent days, the U.S. accused Iran of alleged threats and last week deployed an aircraft carrier group and B-52 bombers to the Gulf. So we'll see where all that leads, because it's unknown at the moment what's going on. Now let's look at some of the stuff that's also going on with the elections, the European elections, that is, and what became of the yellow vest candidates, which is really a big issue. Two candidate lists containing the names of members of France's yellow vest movement, the Gilets Jaunes, who have been demonstrating across the country for some 6 months now, won less than 0.6% in Sunday's European Union vote. Before Sunday's vote began, however, election polls had suggested a majority of supporters of the movement favored the far-right National Rally Party. As European Union voters headed to the election polls on May 26 to elect their new parliament, in France, observers were keeping a close watch on the votes of the yellow vest protesters in the first election since the movement began in November. Among the 34 list of candidates, two were solely composed of yellow vest members. One list, the Yellow Alliance, headed by singer Francis Lalanne, won 0.54% of the vote. The second, the Christopher Chalençon-led Citizen Evolution, won only 0.01%. Apart from these lists, some parties had Gilets Jaunes members amongst their candidates. Other parties also claim to be representing the movement, which every Saturday since November took to the streets of France with their biggest march, culminating in 282,000 protesters. Despite the movement's ability to attract large swaths of followers, these lists failed to reach the 5% threshold needed to get candidates into the European Union Parliament. Initially a protest against proposed fuel tax increases, the Yellow Vest movement quickly snowballed into widespread demonstrations against French President Emmanuel Macron, whom the protesters held responsible for the day-to-day struggles of low earners in small towns and rural France. At the very beginning of the movement, questions were raised over a possible political party to represent the movement directly. As early as December, opinion polls estimated that the then hypothetical yellow vest list of candidates would win around 10% of the European Union Parliament elections. But 6 months later, and the final poll results have shown those projections to be false. Across the country, Sunday's elections turnout reached 50.5%, 8 points higher than the 2014's previous vote. It was also high in France's rural and less inhabited areas, which were strongholds for the Yellow Vest movement. According to an opinion poll by IFOP, published 2 days before the elections, however, 44% of those who supported the Yellow Vest movement said that they would vote for the far-right National Rally, the RN, with only 4% declaring they'd vote for President Emmanuel Macron's La République En Marche. Very clearly, the Yellow Vest's true political outlet in these European Union Parliament elections is the RN. Polling Vox President Jérôme Saint-Maurice argued, but each of the movement's leaders seemed to have voted differently. Thierry Paul Valette had first announced he would lead his own list before giving it up, and then announcing his support for Macron's LREM, and finally preferring not to vote at all. As for Ingrid Levasseur, she initially voted for, she voted up the Yellow Alliance list and then pulled out, finally declaring that she had cast a Green Party ballot instead. According to Agence France-Presse, Jacqueline Moureau said she preferred to submit a blank ballot, while Hervé Giacomoni, spokesman for the Yellow Vest in the Central Eastern Aube, AUBE, announced that he would back the UPR party, who were campaigning for a Frexit, so French exit from the European Union, similar to the Brexit of Britain. So, my goodness, So a lot's been happening. Now, let me just look at a couple of other issues that we should engage in with you. Let's look and see what's going on here in the North and Southern Hemisphere. In the Americas, evidently inmates have strangled to death in a Brazilian prison gang clash. And so just 55 inmates were killed at different prisons in Brazil's northern Amazonas state on Sunday and Monday over an apparent gang dispute, authorities reported, in the latest wave of violence to rock the country's overpopulated prison system. Most of the victims appear to have been killed by asphyxiation, the Amazonas state government said in a statement. At least 40 of the victims were killed in four jails on Monday, a day after officials announced that 15 others had been murdered in one of the detention centers. Officials had initially put the number of dead at 42, but revised it to 40. At least 25 of the dead were found in the Antonio Trindade Penal Institute near Manaus, the capital of the Amazonas, where all four prisons are located. The killings across the city's prisons recalled early 2017 when more than 120 inmates died at the hands of other prisoners during several weeks of fighting among rival crime gang members at prisons in northern states. Now, many of those victims had their heads cut off or their hearts and intestines ripped out. On Sunday, 15 inmates were killed during a riot at Manaus's Anicio Jobim prison complex, where 56 prisoners died in the violence 2 years earlier. No guns or knives were used in the killings, which prison officials said appeared to have been sparked by a rift between prisoners who belonged to the same criminal group and were involved in drug trafficking in the state. The fighting began before noon on Sunday, local authorities said, and secret reinforcements were rushed in and managed to regain control within 45 minutes. Brazil's justice and public security sector and ministry said it was sending a federal task force to help local officials handle the situation. I just spoke with Justice Minister Sergio Moro, who is already sending a prison intervention team to the state of Amazonas so that he can help us in this moment of crisis and a problem that is national, the problem of prisons, Amazonas State Governor Wilson Lima had said. An investigation launched into Sunday's mass killing at the Anicio Jobim penal complex, in which some of the prisoners were stabbed with sharpened toothbrushes during visiting hours, had been widened to include Monday's deaths. The fact that the killings were coordinated across four separate prisons suggests that this was a settling of scores, Robert Muga, the research director of the Igarapé Institute think tank in Rio de Janeiro, advised. The latest violence in Amazonas, one of Brazil's most violent states, was, quote, almost guaranteed to inspire retribution inside and outside the prison walls, end quote. Several drug trafficking and other criminal gangs in Brazil run much of their day-to-day business from prisons where they often have wide sway. 2017 slayings were largely gang-related, prompting authorities to increase efforts to separate factions and frequently transfer prisoners. While outbreaks of deadly violence are a recurring problem in Brazil's jails due to the lack of structural changes, experts say, and prisons continue to be places of serious violations of human rights, said Juliana Mello, a professor at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Norte. The conditions are appalling, with a majority of prisoners poor, black, badly schooled, and marginalized, he added. Brazil has the world's third largest prison population after the United States and China, with 726,712 inmates as of June of 2016, according to official statistics. The population is double the capacity of the nation's jails, which in the same year was estimated to be 368,049 inmates. Federal government had been expected to add another 115,000 inmates by the end of 2018, Human Rights Watch said in a recent post. Well, along with severe overcrowding and gang violence, riots and breakout attempts in Brazil's prisons are not uncommon. So deaths in Brazil's prison system are shamefully recurrent, said Julia Lemgruva, a former member and director of the Rio de Janeiro's penitentiary system and professor at Candido Mendes University. They are recurrent because those who die are originally from the poorest sections of the population and are people who are not clear about their rights. While Muga, who said there was no quick fix available for the system, the government needed to start by drastically reducing the number of prison detainees who currently make up 40% of the prison population. Rather than imposing harsher sentencing laws and building new prisons, the public authorities need to enforce existing legislation, including ensuring suspects are provided with hearings within 24 hours of their arrest, he said. So we'll see where that all goes. You know, a lot of these things are on paper, but they don't get translated into a reality, which is very, very disconcerting, to say the least. Now, let's quickly look at some other issues that are facing the world and go back to see what else is happening. This is important because it's happening with respect to Öcalan. Kurdish prisoners in Turkey and a hunger strike after they appeal, the appeal from Öcalan. It seems that thousands of inmates in Turkish prisons ended their mass hunger strike on Sunday, heeding a calling by militant Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan, whose jail conditions they were protesting. The action had grown to involve some 3,000 people held in different prisons since the last hunger strike was launched last November by a detained lawmaker from the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, the HDP, over Öcalan's isolation in prison. But after the militant leader was allowed to see legal representatives for the first time in 8 years this month, Öcalan told his lawyers the hunger strikes, quote, had achieved their goal and called for them to end. After all, we are ending our hunger strike, the prisoner's representative, Denise Kaya, said in a statement quoted by Kurdish news agency ANF. Now, Öcalan, the co-founder of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, has been held on Imrali Island off of Istanbul since 1999. The first visit by his lawyers took place on May 2nd, after the Turkish authorities lifted an official ban on lawyers' visits in Öcalan. A second trip by two of his lawyers was made on May 22. Now, the hunger strike was initially launched by the Ministers of Parliament, Leyla Güven, while she was in custody, although she was later released. Other detainees then followed a suit. Eight people were killed, also killed themselves over the issue, according to the HDP. Güven, announcing the end of her hunger strike, said in a statement that although the action was successful, quote, our struggle against isolation and our struggle for social peace will continue in all areas, end quote. So, quote, with this resistance, Turkey's peoples, Turkey's democracy has won, Güven told reporters in Diyarbakir in the Kurdish majority southeast. Three other HDP ministers of parliament said they would stop, they would also end their hunger strike. Öcalan's PKK, blacklisted by Ankara and its Western allies as a terror group, has been waging an insurgency against the Turkish state since 1984, during which more than 40,000 people have been killed. Now, Öcalan was caught in February of 1996 in Kenya and jailed several months later after he was found guilty of treason, separatism, and murder. that despite almost complete isolation, Öcalan is still a key figure of the Kurdish insurgency and the movement generally in the region. His lawyers said Öcalan indicated he would play a positive role in Syria in confronting the issues there, including the Kurdish issue, if he was given the chance. Öcalan previously said in a message following the May 2nd visit that Turkey's sensitivities, quote-unquote, should be taken into account in Syria, where the U.S.-backed Kurdish YPG militia is battling the Islamic State group. So Turkey said the YPG is a terrorist offshoot of the PKK. Güven and Öcalan's voice being heard was very important to Turkey's democratization and peace in the Middle East. The visits come just weeks before a controversial rerun of the Istanbul mayoral election, which was lost by the ruling party of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on March 31. Except, say, Kurdish voters or votes, experts say that Kurdish votes played a significant role in Erdogan's party loss, and he is hoping for their support in the repeat vote on June 23. But Turkish Justice Minister Abdul Hamid Gül said on Friday the lawyers' visits, quote, had nothing to do with the peace process and, quote, no link to the Istanbul elections, end quote. Öcalan had carried and called for a ceasefire in 2013 to allow peace talks a chance to reach a negotiated settlement. However, fighting between Turkey and the PKK intensified after the collapse of the ceasefire in the summer of 2015, dashing hopes of a peace solution to the conflict. And Öcalan's lawyers said the rebel chief said that the permission given for these meetings, quote, did not mean the existence of a renegotiation or of a negotiation process. Öcalan noted that Turkey fundamentally needed democratic negotiations and honorable peace, adding through his lawyers that the authorities' reaction to his comments would be clear within 30 to 60 days, but he gave no further details. So not quite sure what all that means, but I guess in time we will find out. Now, let's look at some other concerns. There's really no need. What I'm going to do is I'm going to move over. Bear with me a moment. I'm going to move over to the studio screen because we will be expecting a call from Mayor Mike Spano, who's running for re-election. So in the meantime, let's find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're doing at the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
One of those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
And now we're going to take one more commercial break with regard to the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. If you also want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, you could also reach them at their new office number, which is 347-415-4326. 347-415-4326. And that's their office number, their cell number, their voicemail number, and their text number. So you can reach them any which way you want. And I still haven't figured out smoke signals, but you never know. Who knows? Eventually, we'll all destroy each other, and all this technology will go poof. And by that time, we'll have to know how to send up smoke signals. So that's going to be important in the communication process. Well, we're waiting now for the mayor from Yonkers, who's running for re-election, and. We'll see if he's able to show. Last week he wasn't able to show, even though he was scheduled. And well, we notified his office, so we'll see what happens. Anyway, the thing that's really interesting is, you know, his intention to find out exactly what his vision is for the city. It doesn't look like he has really much credible opposition. He is running for his third term. The people who are running against him barely have made much of a whimper on the political landscape. Probably the candidate that was thought most likely had a capacity and a broad support was that of Karen Beltran, who unfortunately, in her first outing and fundraiser, which was supposed to take place at 66 Main Street, attracted not even 10 people. I think it was a total of 6. So not even 10 people showed up and in support of her. The fact that we just didn't know why it happened. Well, I see we got a call, so let's bring in the caller. Yeah. Good morning, caller. Thanks for waiting.
It's Mike Spano. How are you today?
How are you, Mr. Mayor? What a pleasure to have you on today. I hope you're well.
Oh, I'm doing okay, thank God. How you doing?
Thank God, all right as well. You know, it's very compelling. You're going to be running for re-election, and it was always said, especially in this whole process of this particular election, that people wanted you to stay at the helm. Because there was stuff that still needed to be done. And it was believed and probably very credibly thought that you were the one that could shepherd the city over the next 4 years. And juxtaposed to what you actually said as well was that you thought that you would have 8 years to do your work and the input of your effort was really double that, so it was like a 16 years worth of effort,
right.
Which unfortunately, I must admit to you, unfortunately, your administration has not done such a good job in advising people of what you've done that is positive. So the celebration of what's positive doesn't always come out, and I hope that you would change that demeanor into the future. So. What do you expect to do now for another 4 years? What should we expect from the Spano administration?
I always do try to get out as much of the good news of Yonkers as I possibly can. You know, I completely believe that, you know, when you look at Yonkers as a whole, more good things happen in our city than not, and it's important to tell a good story. But because of the nature of the news, not to you directly, but in the nature of the news in general, sometimes the negative stuff rises to the top, and it's hard to kind of get that message out there. And especially, you know, don't forget where we are. You know, we're just above New York City, and you know,
right.
they don't tend to focus on us. If it's something positive, if it's something negative, you know, the New York City news will jump right all over us. But you know what? We have about $3 billion worth of economic development. We have another potential, at least another potential of another $1 billion worth of economic development to go on the ground. I believe that, you know, one of the things that we were able to do was we took a lot of promise and a lot of hope, and we turned that into, you know, into you know, shovels and cranes in the air, and we're able to get this economic development off the ground, especially in the waterfront. But not only, but not exclusively to the waterfront, but in the waterfront, on the waterfront. We have, you know, while we're the 112th largest city in New York, we're the fourth largest city in New York State, but we're the 112th largest city in America. We've been listed as the safest city of our size in all of America. Now, crime is down 43%. That doesn't mean we don't have crime. Certainly, one bit of violence is unacceptable to any mayor. But the statistics are that we are 43% safer today than we were in 2011, and that's something that I'm proud of. I'm very proud that we've been able to drive the crime rate down. We've done so through a number of means of, you know, that we could talk about, but including a greater community policing. In other words, having the police department actually interact in many different ways with the public. And of course, our schools. You know, we know that Yonkers has been chronically underfunded from Albany, and we know that there's a crumbling infrastructure, and it's something that I've made it my mission to try and get New York State to understand that, to recognize it, and to make substantive changes to the school formula so to allow Yonkers to, you know, achieve its fullest potential. I mean, despite the fact that you have Rochester, New York, getting $150 million more a year in aid to education, we continue to exceed their numbers in terms of graduation rates. We are at 86%, which is 12% higher than it was when I took office. And we're looking at potentially hitting the 90% mark this year. You know, that's big for a city our size.
That is huge. But you know the problem is, what I find disconcerting, and not specifically with you, but what's disconcerting is that we don't hear about this stuff that is worth celebrating. We don't hear about the extra $1 billion in development that you mentioned, or the ones that are already in the ground. And we don't hear about all those things at the schools. Like, for example, one of the schools, Cross Hill Academy, just ended up imploding, literally, because they haven't met the standards of educational excellence that's required. And yet we changed the name 4 years ago. Now we need change them again.
That's right.
So doesn't that actually – it doesn't bear so much on you because you're the oversight committee. In other words, you're supposed to look at all these segments. But doesn't that put into question some of the efficacy of our Board of Education if they can't keep a school up to snuff?
There's no doubt when you have the fourth largest school district in all of New York, and you have 40 different schools, and you have one particular school that's been on a certain list for now 4 years, that the superintendent felt a change needed to be made. Obviously, we are going to monitor that very, very closely, but I can't emphasize enough that there is, here we go again, you know, the overall – but health of the school,
right,
the overall health of the district has gotten better.
Glad.
But that doesn't mean that we don't have issues. It's kind of like when I talk about the crime rate. It doesn't, you know, while overall crime is down 43%, it doesn't mean there isn't any crime. You know, we had a horrible incident where the young lady was shot in the head. But, you know, but the statistics are there. And, you know, but we have a lot more work to do if we want to be perfect. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I am still motivated and want to be mayor, because I believe that we've started so many wonderful things in economic development, making our city safer, and making our city more environmentally friendly, and doing all these things that, you know, I really wanted to take hold. People are finally saying nice things about Yonkers. You know, when I took office, remember, Ezzy, you've been around for a long time, and you've been dealing with the politics in Yonkers for a long time. So I know you know. I mean, people wouldn't even admit they lived. There were some people who wouldn't admit that they lived in Yonkers.
I know.
And
that was pathetic.
Yeah, and you know, it's.
Understand that.
It's, but that's changed. You know, when people say where you live, people kind of proud to say, you know, I live in Yonkers. There are a lot of great things happening in our city, and there are a lot of wonderful people that live here. It's a wonderfully diverse city. You know, 40 years ago, it was a city that was on the brink of disaster. I mean, we're talking about the National Guard coming in and patrolling our streets because of the desegregation order. And here we are now. We passed an affordable housing ordinance, 7-0. 40 years ago, they wouldn't have done that, but they passed it 7-0. And we're building new housing. We're building new affordable housing, new workforce housing. And of course, we're rebuilding all of our MHA units, all 2,000 of them, are being rebuilt. And that's the first time that's been done since the World War. So we are, you know, taking a holistic view of the city and moving the city forward as best we can.
Well, I've got to ask you then, about some of this stuff.
Sure.
You know, we've had Andrea Stewart-Cousins. She was just a senator. Now she's the head of the Democratic majority, in the Senate. So she's one of the people, one of the three people in the room. And then we have Mr. Hastie from the New York State Assembly, and another powerful man who seems to have a likeness for Yonkers. Maybe likeness is not the right word, but he understands Yonkers' issues. So that you know, he's willing to work. Then the assembly member that succeeded you years later, after you were the assemblyman, she was the assemblywoman, and then now she's become a Senate member. And shouldn't there be, from all that power base, from people who've been in office for many years, shouldn't that help us getting, you know, the assistance for municipalities? We haven't had aid in municipalities. I think it's stuck nowhere for 10 years.
Yeah, no, that's
how
that's.
How do they learn our equation?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. Well, let's start off with what they call AMA, right? So that's what you just referred to, aid to municipalities.
Right.
Yeah, that actually has been flat since I took office.
Yeah.
So 2012, it went down $20 million and has stayed remained there ever since. You know, our governor believes, and I don't agree with him on this, much as I love the governor, but I don't agree with him on this, but he kind of believes that AMAID is not something that that the state needs to increase. You know, I look at it this way. AMAID is what they call revenue sharing. That's what it was always called. Mm-hmm. They changed the name of it, but it's still revenue sharing. And while New Yorkers have benefited from this renaissance happening in Yonkers, to the tune of 35% of additional money goes, and I don't know what that quantifies in dollars, but additional money goes to the state capital. But yet our revenue sharing has remained flat. That's something that has to be addressed. I address it. I speak about it every time I go to Albany, and that would help us because it'll help us with our contracts. It'll help us, you know, because we, as you know, especially the municipal side, the labor contracts will be expired this year. They were 10-year deals,
right?
And they're already going to be expired. Right. So, you know, we need that recognition from the state capitol where they say, "Hey, we are a partner in with." The big cities, because the big cities handle a lot of the burden that the rest of New Yorkers don't have. You know, I mean, much of our population is vulnerable. Much of our population has high needs. Much of our population, it will cost a lot of money. And you have an already overburdened taxpayer. We're at 92% of our constitutional taxing limit. So even if the political will was there to raise taxes to the max, it still wouldn't be enough to solve the problem. So New York State, and that's why I keep on going back to New York State, saying fund us fairly, where our kids live some 70% or better, and I think the number is better than 70%, but I'll give you 70 because I know that number lives at or right the rate below the rate of poverty. You know, so now we're the same size school. We're the same size school district as Rochester, but you're sending Rochester $150 million more a year than you're sending Yonkers. I mean, think about that. Mm-hmm. That's just insane. To go back to what you said though about the leadership, I am very optimistic that having the Senate Majority Leader representing Yonkers and having the having our education chair. Who lives in Yonkers as well, and having two majority members in the assembly, is going to pay off for Yonkers. It has started to. I mean, we got some additional dollars this year, but we're still. The real fix is a change in the formula, and you know the good thing
But all the years that you were the assemblyman, and then you became the mayor. Where's the disconnect? What is it that New York State doesn't recognize that we're not able to somehow translate for them in language that they will understand to fork over our fair share, not greater share, but just a fair share, so that we're commensurate with other communities? Where is the disconnect? Because I don't get it. I just don't see it.
Well, think about it. When you're in the state legislature, and the dynamic is this: when you give one community more money, some other community is going to get less money, right? So you're dealing with 212 legislators, all of whom do not want to give up any bit of the piece of the pie that they have. It really requires leadership at the three people in the room level, and which we never achieved. We were close, and we had Nick. We had Senator Spano there, you know, he was very instrumental. Right. I mean, I think he gave us like $70 million in reoccurring aid.
Yeah, he was.
The year he lost. And so, you know, there is real value to being at the leadership table. And I really believe that, I think that, you know, having Senator Cousins, who I think is very acutely aware of what our needs are, we'll be able to produce for us. And she's just brand new as the leader. So, you couldn't really expect the formula to be fixed in 1 year. But I have to tell you, I think that you're going to be very surprised as we move forward as to what she's able to accomplish for us.
Well, that's compelling. We're only supposed to be on for 15 minutes, and we're going to speak to you next week. So I don't want to push your time schedule beyond that.
All right.
But I want to thank you for making the time for us today, and I look forward to our next talks.
Take care, Hesse. Thank you.
Oh, you know, before you go, can you tell us how do people reach out if they want to help you in your campaign effort? Because you probably have a website.
Yes, we do. It's MikeSpano.com.
Okay.
MikeSpano.com. And
I get everything over there?
Yeah. Yes, you can. Yeah, you can reach out to
Okay.
All right. Also, if you want to reach out to me, officially, you can get me at obviously at YonkersNY.gov.
Perfect. Well, thank you again, Mr. Mayor. A pleasure.
All right.
All the best.
All right, thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. Mayor Mike Spano is running for re-election. And so we'll be able to talk to him about other issues because there's so much to talk about. But that's basically it. So let me just quickly look to see if there's anything else that we've missed with respect to us on the national level and on the political level. And so bear with me a moment. Where is it here? I think we're fine on most situations. There is one thing that is a bit of a problem, and that is with respect to what's going on in Mount Vernon. And we are also going to have an article that will be coming out in another few hours with respect to Yonkers. Okay, so where is it here? Oh, yeah, this is the thing that we wrote up about. Evidently, Mayor Richard Thomas's lawyers, there are Floridian lawyers, assert that he has been exonerated for misusing Mount Vernon Board of Water Supply funds. So they wrote, it was late Friday night, well, on May 24th, actually, when LoHUD reported that Mount Vernon Mayor Richard Thomas's lawyers asserted that the grand jury looking into the use of the Mount Vernon Board of Water Supply funds on behalf of Richard Thomas's personal legal bills had declined to indict the mayor, to which Mayor Thomas proclaimed victory. So the public is asked to believe that Thomas's lawyers take away without validation from a second legal source, such as who impaneled the grand jury. So, which begs the question, why and why not? It seems incongruous that a grand jury impaneled in White Plains, New York, completed their inquiry, yet upon completion of their task and responsibility, that no official statement was made of their findings. Now, that's ridiculous. And it's interesting enough that the lawyers representing Mayor Thomas evidently are Floridian-based. They don't have the right to practice in New York State. They issued a statement that they sent only to LoHUD. Naturally, we don't matter because we didn't get the statement, which is the failings of Mount Vernon's communication department, but that's not my fault. It doesn't matter. We barely need them for anything anyway, because we have enough sources of our own. We don't need anyone in government, whether it be in Yonkers, whether it be in Mount Vernon, or any other place that's of interest. So it seems just incongruous that they have the right to speak up when they can't even be brought to heel here in Westchester County or in the state of New York. They have no right to answer here. So why did they say what they said? So LoHUD informed its readers that Thomas's Florida-based lawyers had, in a press release, which was not received by the Yonkers Tribune, Mount Vernon Tribune, quoted Mayor Thomas saying, "I am proud that my faith that in our system of justice has been reaffirmed." No, it hasn't. Nothing's been done yet. There is no conclusion. If there was a conclusion by the grand jury, then they would have issued a public statement. They don't just have grand juries that come and go and nobody even knows what they've done. There's a reason for a grand jury. So where's the official statement at that? And that's the question. So who impaneled this grand jury? There was talk that's conceivable it was the New York State Attorney General, Letitia James. We find that is not the case. It was not her office that initiated this the grand jury. Haven't yet confirmed it, but it seems someone a little bit closer to home. So it's very conceivable that the district attorney, Mr. Anthony Scarpino, was the one that impaneled this grand jury. So we'll have to see who's who. And if that's the case, then we will need to await whoever impaneled this grand jury, which tells me that if it is the Anthony Scarpino's office, then we will hear from them hopefully today. Unfortunately for us, we don't hear from Scarpino's office since Deirdre Spano got the job with the Scarpino administration. They have stopped sending us any notices whatsoever, which I will also put in writing, which is outrageous. But hey, it is just what it is. So that's the story there. Now, we'll have to see exactly where this is going to go, and this is the most important issue, that neither Thomas nor his lawyers would offer details about what payments were made. And Bandler noted that according to the press release, the mayor and his lawyers maintained that Thomas received sound counsel from Mount Vernon Corporation Counsel Lawrence A. Polcari, Jr., who is Esquire, with respect to payments made by the Mount Vernon Board of Water Supply. Now it turns out the Mount Vernon Tribune, Yonkers Tribune sources advise us that Lawrence Polcari, Jr., will soon face indictment proceedings, and we understand it's going to take place this Wednesday. So we'll just have to wait and see. We'll see if we're right. And until then, more information as it's gleaned. So I see it's about 11:30, rather, or very close to it. So we'll call it a day. And we just hope everything's well with you at your end. It was a solemn, long weekend. And I hope people do remember, even though so many people are not connected to a major war and major crisis. We no longer have world wars like we did in World War II. We don't have major crises like in Vietnam, which was a long-standing war, and other issues in other places around the world. And thank God for that. But we lost a lot of people. And their memories should not be forgotten because our present generation has not been witness to war. And I guess to some extent one can say that on the backs and on the blood and the loss of life by so many who fought for the nation in the past, that we are able to live in a state of basic peace, even though we've got people in the military that are in the front lines, whether they're on the front line in Afghanistan in support of the Kurdish population in Syria, whether they're battling to maintain the oil pipelines and the oil routes for distribution of oil in the Middle East. And we have to send our troops and our battleships and so on and so forth, and the amount of killings that are taking place on an individual basis. We've got terrorists all over the world. So it's a different world. So, but people are sacrificing their lives in support of what they believe and what many people believe is the basis for America and its freedoms. That's why people actually are not dying, but living for the intention of coming to the United States. So it's an attraction. America is still an attraction of high hopes and capacity to grow one's fortunes, not only mentally, but physically and socially and financially. So that's something to remember. And hopefully it's considered part and parcel of one's personal understanding of the nation of the United States. And we go from there. So, again, I want to thank you for being with us. And I guess that's about it. So we've covered our bases today, and we'll tell you what else is going on as we move into the future. All the best and good day. Oh, you know what? Before we go, let's tell you what's happening tomorrow. Tomorrow's Wednesday. Oh, so we're going to be speaking to Lorraine Lopez from 10 to 10:30. And then we're going to speak to mayoral candidate Sean Patterson Howard from 10:30 to 11. And we were supposed to speak to Commissioner Clyde Isley, today, but because he couldn't make it, we were able to reschedule him for 11 o'clock on Friday the 31st. So we're going to still have him next by the end of the week. And so that's the story at the moment. And we thank you for being with us. So all the best. Take care. Let me go back to our studio screen and wish you a good day. Bye.